We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and today is March 31st, and it's the birthday of Herb Alpert, if you remember him, Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, Gordie Howe, an old-time, relatively old-time hockey player, Rhea Perlman from Cheers, Ewan McGregor, and Al Gore. Today is the 60th birthday of Al Gore, former U.S. Vice President, and he's just in the news this week with this new initiative. He's planning to spend $300 million on an advertising campaign to show that global warming is a bipartisan issue, as we discussed in the last hour. Anyway, let me get back to the situation in the war on terror, as the president likes to call it. And as John McCain says, or claims, it is the issue of our time. I think personally that that's crap, that we are elevating these people to a status they don't deserve because they were smart enough or clever enough to use our own technology against us, take four of our airplanes and crash them, and do hundreds of billions of dollars of damage to our economy and damage to our psyche. But this is not the seminal issue of our time, or the number one issue of the 21st century, as the president has called it. That would be like in the year 1901 through 1908, declaring that you knew what the most important issue of the 20th century was. No! Even if you'd stretched it to 1914 and you had World War I to bank on, you would think that would be it? No. It turns out World War II was a bigger deal. It turns out the stock market crash and the worldwide depression was a bigger deal. It turns out the Cold War was probably a bigger deal on one level. Bottom line, you can't tell in the first few years of a century what the most important issue is. But I can tell you this, people aren't going to look back at the end of the 21st century and say terrorism was the defining issue of either the century or even of our lives. Those of us who are, I'm 57, I plan to live till, about 2035, maybe 2040. That would make me 85 or 90. And there will be other big issues. And there already are big issues beyond terrorism. We're turning this small ragtag band of malcontents that don't really have very much power into this powerful force. And that's a mistake. And, of course, not getting Osama was a mistake. In any case, the president was in Ohio this week, in Dayton, as a couple of things happened. First of all, we got this renewed fighting in Iraq, so casualties are up for the U.S. They're bombing the green zone again, and people have started dying in the green zone again. And we reached the 4,000th casualty last week. 4,000 Americans have died in Iraq. And the president and John McCain are out there basically saying the surge is working. Let me again explain why the surge can never work. John McCain wants to paint Obama and Clinton as naive and claim that if we pulled out of Iraq now, it would be a disaster. That's what the Bush administration says. That's what the neocons say. That's what most Republicans and conservatives say. Again, I've got news for you. If we pull out of Iraq, there will be bloodshed. But it would happen no matter when we pull out. It isn't like five more years of stabilizing Iraq, and then when we pull out, things will have settled down. You can hope for that, but this conflict goes back at least 800 years. And there's fundamental disagreements about beliefs and wrongs that have never been righted. And the idea that we can step in and for 5 or 10 years of keeping two parties or three parties at arm's length, suddenly we're going to have a viable peace and even a democracy, is ludicrous. Now, I understand why Bush has refused to pull out. He would like to see the next president blamed for the mess in Iraq, because whenever we pull out, we say, well, if we'd stayed, it would have gotten better. No, it won't get better. When we pull out, Iraq's going to go through growing pains and there's going to be bloodshed. Eventually, they will figure out how they want to rule their country. But there's a reason why most, what do I want to call them? I don't want to say primitive cultures. Most cultures that are at the first, second, or third level of spiral dynamics, there's a reason why they usually have a dictator or a strongman leading them. You need somebody willing to crack heads together and keep order in these countries. And that's the model that usually gets put in place. Now, for expediency, when we want to work with a third world country, and by that we mean we want to buy their oil, or we want their minerals, or we want something from them because of their strategic location, we look the other way usually. You know, Bush's effort in this area was short-lived, but basically after we went into Iraq and the weapons of mass destruction argument fell apart, Bush moved to the democracy argument. And he said, we will no longer tolerate these despots just because they're convenient for us. And Condoleezza Rice went to Egypt and said, this will not stand. And she did get them to ease up for a little while on some of their dissidents. But they're right back to being hardliners. And the last time she went back there, she ate crow and had to admit, essentially, when you read between the lines, they stood there and smiled. Well, Condoleezza Rice says, Egypt is a good friend of ours. We're paying them, I don't know if it's $1.2 or $2 billion a year, and we have been since the peace accords of 77 with Israel. It was 79. And we've been paying that money to Egypt, and what do we have to show for it? Not much. But the Bush administration has backtracked on their democracy argument. These countries are not ready for democracy. And every time that got mentioned, politely, Condi Rice would say things like, oh, so you don't think they're mature enough? You don't think these people deserve it just because they're a little backwards? No, it's not a matter of deserve. As Clint Eastwood said in Unforgiven, deserve's got nothing to do with it. It's a matter of whether the culture's ready for it. And so by removing the strongman from Iraq, we were setting up a potential chaos. There's a power vacuum. People will rush to fill it. Until a leader emerges or a workable system of government emerges in Iraq, there will be bloodshed. We can keep a lid on it a bit while we're there if other people cooperate. But as long as if they stop cooperating, and Sadr may very well now stop, you can kiss the ceasefire goodbye. So we don't have as much control over there as McCain and the Bush administration would have you believe. But the rhetoric from the right just drives me crazy because they say we have to win in Iraq and the Democrats want to surrender. No, it's not about winning or losing. This is the problem, as we've talked before, with the black and white view of the world. Conservatives and 20%ers, particularly 20%ers on the far right, but infects a percentage on the far left, believe that everything's black and white. So when Harry Reid says, we're losing in Iraq, the Republicans jump on it and say, well, if we're losing, that means someone's winning. Are you saying Al-Qaeda's winning? No, Al-Qaeda's only 5% of the population. Are you saying that the insurgents are winning? No, there are gray areas. It's possible for both sides to lose in a war. You don't have to have a winner. But simplistic thinking requires everything have a black or white counterpart. In any case, we've reviewed the fact that there's a mess in Pakistan. We reviewed the fact there's a mess in Iraq. And let me see. I guess the other thing that I want to talk about is that General Petraeus is coming to town in a few weeks, and he'll talk about security gains that we've made in Iraq. And we are talking about a pause in the troop reduction. All right. So the principle here is that we've removed enough troops that we're back down almost to pre-surge levels, back where we were at the time of the Baker report, which was November of 2006, going on 18 months ago. And they recommended we get out because there was nothing better to do. They left Bush a sliver of hope put in by Republicans who, at the behest of the White House, that said, but you could temporarily try a small surge if you thought that could really do something to stabilize things. So Bush took it because the alternative was pulling out. And now he's got it back to where we were, 140,000 roughly, or we will have by the time he finishes this pullout this summer. And they want to pause it, okay? Take a look around, see what's going on. You always want to listen to the generals on the ground. But at some point, someone has to take responsibility for a colossal mistake. The country knows it was a mistake, and yet we can't face it. And what's interesting, and I'll come back to this in after the break, what's interesting is the same rationale applies here as applied before. The people who said that we lost Vietnam because we didn't fight till the end are the same ones who say now, if we leave, we lose, but if we stay, we have a chance to win. No, Vietnam wasn't winnable, despite what John McCain may say or George W. Bush believes. And Iraq is not winnable, not in any real sense. There's going to be a mess. Somebody's going to rise to fill the power vacuum, and we aren't going to get much say in that. Could I be any clearer than that? In any case, we are going to move on, and we're going to listen to a little juxtaposition here of music. We got a little bit of Jimi Hendrix, Purple Haze, followed by a little bit of Cat Stevens, Longer Boats. And the reason? It was on this day in 1967 that these two bands toured together. If you can believe it, well, believe it. Here's Hendrix, Purple Haze.
taken the key from the door. Boats are coming to win us, they're coming to win us, they're coming to win us. The longer boats are coming to win us, hold on to the shore. They'll be taking the key from the door. I don't want no God on my lawn, just a flower I can help along, 'cause the soul of nobody knows how a flower grows. It's how a flower grows. Along the boats are coming to win us, they're coming to win us, they're coming to win us. Along the boats are coming to win us, hold on to the shore. They'll be taking the key from the door. Mary dropped her pants by the sand and let a parson come and take her hand. But the soul of nobody knows where the parson goes. Does the parson go?
Greetings, sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to the Andy Finn Show,
the smooth talk of the town.
Cool. We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and let's wrap up about Iraq by just saying this, that all summer long we're going to hear the rhetoric that McCain knows what he's doing and that we can't leave Iraq because, A, it will waste the sacrifice of the 4,000 we've lost so far, and B, there'll be a bloodbath. But these people, and by that I mean the Bush administration, John McCain, the neocons, they have been wrong about just about every prediction they've made about Iraq. And if you go back, it was the same crowd, roughly, the conservatives and Republicans who were arguing that you can't pull out of Vietnam because of the domino theory. We were wrong about that. And nobody goes back and says, oh yeah, we were wrong about that. We should change our view. No, they go on and they make their next set of predictions. Bill Kristol's a perfect example of that. He is wrong about almost everything he suggests, and he holds forth on television and in his magazine as though he's competent at predicting the future even 10-20% of the time. It's really pretty remarkable. It's time to stop listening to doom and gloomers who say, oh, you can't do X, it would be a disaster. You know, hey, where are they on global warming? They don't accept the same logic when it comes to global warming, so you can see it's a political thing. But they hide behind the troops and say, we can't pull out because it would waste the sacrifice of the first 4,000. What about the sacrifice of the next 4,000? Because we are not going to solve this problem. Anyway, Zbigniew Brzezinski had an editorial in yesterday's Washington Post titled The Smart Way Out of a Foolish War. And he basically, I like him because he recommends just about everything I've been talking about since we got into this war, but for the last couple of years, that A, getting out is not going to be the disaster everybody thinks. Part of the problem is we are an occupying force. This is an occupation. You can say what you want about it. The U.S. is occupying Iraq. And it may be that the current government wants us there, but that's because we're keeping them in power. So occupation never works in any country. It certainly never works in the Middle East. And we've overstayed our welcome. Brzezinski talks about a variety of other things that this could help us undo. Basically, Bush and Cheney made a colossal blunder, and they're saying, we don't dare undo it. We have to undo it. So read Brzezinski's article, but otherwise, I'm going to stop there, except to say that The Bush administration is still using the rhetoric of good and evil, right? They're basically backing Prime Minister Maliki going into Basra, right, and saying that he's going to reestablish the rule of law, or National Security Advisor Hadley said that last week. But it's not that simple, okay? Basically, the Iraqi government is trying to suppress its political enemies. And so this is a mess, and it's time we admitted it's a mess. And all the rhetoric to the contrary, that it's about democracy, or we must win in Iraq. I want the Bush administration, I want John McCain to define winning. What does it mean to say we must win in Iraq? Define what a win is. Don't just tell me when the country stabilized. It was stabilized 3 months ago. How many years does it have to be stabilized? How many billions are you willing to spend? We've spent something approaching, well, we spent more than $500 billion, and we're already committed to at least $1 trillion, and some experts are saying it'll be between $2 and $3 trillion that we're pouring into Iraq overall, all the expenses, the medical bills for soldiers coming home, everything. By the time you add it up over their entire lives, this war will cost us $3 trillion. You know, people talk about McCain as a fiscal conservative and that he wants to cut the budget, but spending $1 trillion or more on something like this is hardly being fiscally responsible either. Well, we got an election coming up that'll settle all this, so I will be glad to see that. There was an interesting piece last week in the Washington Post. There are 42 Democrats who have gotten together and vowed that if they are elected, these are candidates for the House of Representatives, and they vowed that if they get elected, they will push for legislation calling for an immediate drawdown of troops. And even though most politicians believe the economy is the number one issue, these folks are saying this is still an issue of the war. You can vote for Republicans and we'll keep it going. They'll keep it going, or you can vote for Democrats and we'll get out. So we will see. But I have to tell you that anybody who bets against a Democratic landslide and a Barack Obama win this fall is not reading the people right. The country's tired of this war. And unlike Bush, they're not worried about his legacy. They're not worried whether it looks like he made a mistake or it looks like he pulled out too early. The Iraqi people will settle this however they settle it, and we'll continue to support him even after we pull troops out. But occupying this country just doesn't make sense. So we'll see how it all plays out. But the last thing I want to talk about is an interesting little piece that was in the Washington Post this morning. I've quoted before from this article. There's an interesting article every Monday in the Washington Post called The Department of Human Behavior. And it's written by a guy by the name of Shankar Venditam. And I have to assume he's got a PhD in psychology or something, but he's always looking at at recent research in psychology or psychological research and what impact it has in the real world, like perhaps for politicians. And in this one, he talks about it's subtitled Hillary Clinton and the Action Bias. And basically, it talks about Hillary taking action, and it quotes her from 2002 when she voted for to give Bush the power to use force in Iraq. She said, quote, "In balancing the risk of action versus inaction, I think New Yorkers who have gone through the fires of hell may be more attuned to the risk of not acting. I know that I am." And of course, Bush and Cheney did the same thing. Their argument post 9/11 is that we cannot wait. We cannot afford to wait. With knowing that terrorists are out there and that there are weapons of mass destruction in the world, we must preempt. This is called the bias to action. And it's really interesting. The best way to explain it is to cite this one gentleman's studies. And what he did was he looked at soccer goalies. Now, if you know what happens when there are penalty kicks, like if a game is tied, they end with 5 penalty kicks each. Most people score on penalty kicks. The goal is big. The kicker's not that far away. And so 9 out of 10 goals get scored, maybe 95 out of 100 against a penalty kick. The goalie has trouble stopping them. But what the goalie stands in the center, and what the goalie does usually is makes a decision, guesses, and dives to the right or dives to the left. But it turns out this study shows that the goalie would have the best odds of stopping the penalty kick if they stay right in the middle of the goal, right? But they almost always choose to dive to the right or dive to the left, hoping to guess right. But even when they dive in the right direction, they only stop the kick 25% of the time because they're stretching their body out on the ground and it could go over their head. There's any number of reasons why they might miss the kick. So it turns out that if you stay in the center, you stop the goal a third of the time. But if you dive to the right or the left, you stop at approximately 13 to 14% of the time. So much better to not take action, to stand right there and wait for the kick to come to you. Right? But goalies can't resist taking action, because if you just stand there, you'll be criticized by the fans and the coach saying, why didn't you go for the ball? Even though you're maximizing the outcomes. It's the same with anything. It works with stocks as well. If the stock market's going down, people say, I should sell. Because if you don't do anything and you're losing money, you feel like a chump. If it's going up and you've made a lot of money, people say, well, I'll stay in. You know, it'd be foolish to sell now. But eventually it's going to stop going up. But we have this bias towards action when things are going bad, and a bias towards not taking action when things are going well. So it's a fascinating article if you want to read it here. But I'm going to leave it at that, because we are out of time here tonight. And that'll do it for another edition of the Andy Finn Show. I'll be back next Monday night on tape or CD, because the Final Four will be on, the final championship game. Until then, you can read my stuff at andyfinn.us. That's andyfinn.us. Until then, remember, do it. Don't doubt it.